When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
A novel granted by a very accomplished historian. Sanson knows what he's talking about. He's a very accomplished, very experienced historian. He really does tell a really emotive tale in his books about what it's like for a man to live with disability and a visible disability.
Hello and welcome to the pod, and this is a quick bonus episode for you. First, I wanted to pay tribute to the great writer C.J. Sansom, who died on Saturday, the 27th of April. His set of historical novels, which were always guaranteed to hit the bestseller lists, have been hugely influential, so much so that we now see a new Disney series, Shard Lake, released today, 1st of May, and starring Sean Bean and Arthur Hughes. So with that in mind, I'm speaking with the historical consultant behind the show, Peter Wagstaff. We did have a few issues with the sound, so please accept my apologies. I should mention that this interview took place before the announcement of the death of Sansom came through. Peter Wagstaff, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Peter, look, it's great to have you on because I was very keen to speak to a historical consultant to talk about the new show, Shard Lake, which I watched the first episode, and the reason why I was wanting to get you on to discuss, really, because it throws up a few interesting topics that I've not really covered on the podcast so far. Predominantly, though, you know, so a few of the subjects are dissolution of the monasteries. Mm-hmm. There is the whole idea around how was deformity or disabled people dealt with in the Tudor period, which I guess is difficult to know, but those are the sort of two most obvious ones. And also, you know, a few other things around crime in the period, that sort of thing. But I thought we'd just start off. We know from the first episode, Anne Boleyn has just been, well, recently executed. We have Sean Bean is Thomas Cromwell.
We do. That's very exciting. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I'm a huge fan of Sean Bean, as most people are.
As am I. I am the first to say, yeah.
I mean, he's almost reached godlike status for me. But I always did envisage Thomas Cromwell to be sort of similar to a sort of Sean Bean-like character, as opposed to the Cromwell that Hilary Mantel writes so brilliantly about in...
Ooh, that's such an interesting question. And it's a really interesting one to delve into. But personally, could I just quickly correct what I'm sure was a slip of the tongue at the very start? I think you referred to it as Sheldrake, Shard Lake.
Shard Lake, that's
what I'm... remiss of me as someone who worked on the project not to, to point that out for the sake of...
Patrick's got his head Shardlake. In his hands. The beauty of the editing process, I shall... Yes, thank
you. I'm sure. I apologize. Well, yes, all the depictions of Cromwell. Yeah, I don't disagree with you that I see Cromwell in historical context as an historian, as he was a lad who pulled himself up by his bootstraps from a working class Putney background. He was incredibly intelligent. He was a doer. He was a diplomat. He was very well educated, although we know very little about how, where he was educated. But he was also a bit of a thug. There's no getting around that. And whereas you're right, perhaps the Mantel version tells the flip side of that. But I think Hilary Mantel and Una Wolf Hall really tells a story of perhaps what's more going on behind the eyes and behind the fists or the money ledgers of Cromwell. I think it's an equally valid interpretation of Cromwell. I think they're two different sides of him, which both deserve to be told.
Yeah, because often depictions often tell us more about who we are than the time itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So do you think we've moved on then? I don't want to sort of dwell too long on the Wolf Hall side of things, because I think the Sean Bean, he does come across as he wants precision is the key thing that he wants about his investigator in the first episode.
Yeah.
I think that's something that he mentions. So that isn't sort of a, I mean, obviously he looks and he sort of fills up the screen because that's Sean Bean's sort of presence and all that. Mm-hmm. But he has that menacing element to him. But do you think then that, you know, we've moved on in the 10 years in our depictions of Cromwell?
What do you mean, since Wolf Hall?
Yeah.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see that. As you say, this isn't really a place to talk about Wolf Hall. We're talking about Shardlake. But of course, we are about to see the second season of Wolf Hall, which is just wrapped, and which I have been working as historian, one of the historians on as well. So I don't think we've lost that telling, the more Mantell telling of Cromwell. I'm glad we haven't, but I think it will be great to see on screen the Sansom version of it as well.
Well, just at a high level, the production's been incredible with the costume is just fantastic. I noticed from the credits it's filmed in Hungary.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which I guess I assumed we've got plenty of castles knocking around that presumably we could have just filmed there.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Yeah, and it unfortunately meant that I couldn't do any actual on set work because I couldn't get out to Hungary. But I gather I didn't work in locations for these productions, or certainly not for this production anyway. But I gather that I stand corrected if I'm wrong about this, but I think maybe the director found a location which he particularly liked. And he has an eye for locations, does this director, Justin. I've actually worked with him before on other period dramas, on Becoming Elizabeth a couple of years ago. And location aesthetic is really important for this show, because unlike a lot of period dramas, this show is set almost exclusively on one set, on one location, in this one monastery where all the drama goes down. So I think if the production found their dream spot, where they think it's going to have the right atmosphere that they want, then they set it upon that in Hungary, yeah. It did raise all kinds of challenges, of course, for having what is essentially a British production based in Hungary. And you mentioned costume. Yeah, the costumes are really beautiful. And the designer, Bart Harris, he's very experienced in Tudor production work. He also actually worked on Becoming Elizabeth. He was the costume designer for that as well. And I've worked with him before on those costumes. And it was initially, in fact, he that asked me to do some advice on this, because I did a lot of work for the clerical costumes on Becoming Elizabeth. And of course, a lot of the costumes in this show are clerical in Shardlake, because it's set in a monastery. We have a lot of monks and they want to get those right. They want them to be colourful and quirky and hooky and eerie. And they want each costume to be different and to tell the story of each character. Unlike, say, if it were a super authentic monastic setting, you might have them all dressed exactly the same. It was important for them not to do that, because they wanted each of the monks to be dressed slightly differently to not only visually differentiate them for clarity for the viewer, but also to paint the picture of what the character is behind all of these monkish robes. And I think they did it really beautifully.
Well, it deals with, and it's based on C.J. Sansom's novel, Dissolution.
That's right, yeah.
And this is probably a seismic event in British history, in English, and British history.
European even, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. So, and obviously Cromwell is at the forefront of the dissolution of the monasteries, the sort of spear point of Henry VIII's weapon, shall we say. But I mean, I was early on in the scene that we have a dinner scene where they are eating the most fantastic food, and I'm on Thomas Cromwell's side here, like, dissolve the bloody lot. because they've all got far too much money. Now, the monasteries, obviously, my idea was sort of pious Spartan places, but that's not the case of this monastery, is it?
Ooh, well, it's certainly not the case in this monastery as Sansom has depicted it. And it's worth mentioning at this point and bearing in mind at every point that, and this did rather complicate my role. This is, we have to remember, the TV adaptation of historical fiction, of a novel, you know, and a novel granted by a very accomplished historian. Sansom knows what he's talking about. He's a very accomplished, very experienced historian. You're talking about the dissolution generally and the state of the monasteries in the 16th century. The story that Sansom tells is not, as far as we know, inaccurate. This was common enough. There were plenty of examples of monasteries which were considerably more Spartan, as you put it. And we can see from a lot of the visitation records when Cromwell would send his people out, his commissioners out to the monasteries to audit them and to see what's going on and to see just how decadent they really are. And indeed, the Shard Lake drama around this first book is circles around what happens to that commissioner who is sent to the monastery. Quite often, these commissioners come back to Cromwell with pretty sparse documents, with a lot of fabricated evidence. There's a lot of slightly dodgy and circuitous language where they know that they've been commissioned by Cromwell to find as much decadence and sodomy as they possibly can. And actually, they haven't really found any. That's not the case always. I personally haven't done a study in what the ratios are of decadent versus Spartan monasteries in the 16th century. But there are, a bit like the two stories of Cromwell, there are two stories to be told about the state of the monasteries at the time.
Indeed, indeed. And well, you're being, you know, hugely diplomatic, and I very much admire you for that. Because yes, as you say, we're talking about a drama based on a historical fiction novel. But do we have a rough idea of the amounts of cash? And I know it's very difficult to estimate, but do we know how much financially was gained by the dissolution of the monasteries?
Oh, well, I mean, I couldn't personally put a figure on it, if only because if there's one thing I'm not desperately expert in, it's medieval currency conversion. But it was a considerable proportion of GDPR, as a modern economist might put it. It went a very long way to bolstering the royal coffers. And not only that, but a lot of the estates were then bought out by the local nobility. And, you know, of course, spoilers for this particular series, but this is a monastery which Cromwell is trying to shut down. Does he succeed? Does he not? If he does, what happens to it afterwards? Well, Cromwell himself lived in a palace which was a formerly dissolved monastery, which he got a bargain price. But yes, the wealth that was quote-unquote recovered or confiscated or stolen or whatever you like to say from the monasteries was very considerable indeed.
He's a canny man, that Cromwell.
He certainly was.
So Shard Lake himself is a fascinating character, actually. And he is disabled. And so I wondered how, do we know anything about how disabled people were treated in the Tudor period?
We do, but rather predictably, I suppose, almost exclusively from the perspective of the non-disabled. I don't know, I'm afraid to say, how much written record we have from the perspective of people who were disabled. I'm sure C.J. Sansom has done more research into this, in fact, than I have. But he really does tell a really emotive tale in his books about what it's like for a man to live with disability, and a visible disability at the time. This is a man who has what we would now consider or call, say, severe scoliosis, but who they call hunchback and crookback. And how would this have been seen? Well, it would have been seen as representative of sin and of uncleanness. And that even if he himself wasn't a sinner, certainly his parents or ancestors were. And you know, he walks down the street and people spit on him or near him or cross themselves as he passes, because where a crookback walks, the devil is sure to be nearby. And however, what Sansom does really, really well is he deals with this in a really emotive and sensitive way, in a way that's also really troubling. And I really applaud the production for not shying away from this at all. It would have been easy to play this down a bit, because it's not an easy subject to talk about. Sansom has really focused on how Shardlake's disability does not own him. It does not become him. He is not his disability. It's a factor particularly in his psyche and in how other people relate to him, but not in really how he relates to others. For instance, he feels self-conscious about the fact that he can't wield a sword as well as other people might be able to, but that we see as much about how he compensates for that in his incredible sharp intelligence and his bravery and his ability to manipulate relationships in really clever ways. And he is disabled, but he is not his disability. And Sansom does that beautifully in the books. And I really think that Stephen Burchard has captured that really fantastically in the screenwriting as well.
Yes, yeah, so much so that, the viewer, I think, at least certainly myself, you almost forget about it in certain scenes where he's, his wit shines through. Are there any kind of, because obviously crime occurred, one assumes, regularly in the Tudor period. Do we know much about, I mean, we're 300 odd years before Robert Peel's Bobbies. Is there any kind of law enforcement that we would in any way vaguely recognise today?
Not really in a way that we would recognise today. Certainly there was no preventative law enforcement, really. No police force that was a bobby on the beat who would prevent crime or anything like that, or dissuade it. The only thing dissuading crime is the fear of retribution or of punishment. But for an awful lot of people, that fear was fairly far removed from the act of crime itself, because what are the chances you're going to get caught? Pretty slim. Especially at different levels of society, right? So Shardlake himself is a lawyer. And he either prosecutes or protects people in courts charged with crimes. But these people are not usually peasants on the street charged with beating people up or nicking a loaf of bread or whatever. That was absolutely endemic. Law enforcement was really, as I say, it was more punishment for crimes that could reasonably be proven after the fact. And it was usually financial reparations or imprisonment, unless you were at the really top level. And even then, conviction rates, bringing anything to trial was very difficult, because it's just one man's word against someone else's. So crime was absolutely endemic at the time. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, that's fascinating to think about. I almost think, identity theft must have been just so easy, whereas, it's almost impossible.
Identity theft.
You could pretend to be anyone you wanted, couldn't you?
I suppose you could, but to what end? Nowadays, of course, identity theft is tied up with your finances and your property, a part of who you are. Your identity has value. Back in those days, identity theft, I think, would be more to do with, say, fraud. Shardlake, walks around dressed as a lawyer or dressed as a junior nobleman, this sort of thing. Well, what we do know is that confidence tricksters, this was extremely common. Criminals would walk around dressed like lawyers or like noblemen or like knights. And because they are just trusted, they can get away with anything. They can run up a big bar tab at the pub, or they can extort local businesses for protection rackets, even though they're not a nobleman, they're not a lawyer, they're nobody, but they just got the right clothes. That was really, really common. I think that's probably the nearest equivalent to what you might call, say, the modern identity theft.
Interesting.
In terms of identity theft, I suppose really just talking about nicking people's money, and that would have been common enough, certainly, at the time.
Okay, so look, this comes at a time. The show's the depiction is at a time of huge tumult. We're looking at the Reformation. How much would that have affected your average Joe? Obviously, for a monastery, and the events in the show, that this is significant. But for the man in the street, for the woman in the street,
well, it's it would have impacted them enormously, largely because the monasteries were going, not just because these people might have to worship slightly differently, say in English instead of Latin, but this drama is set in the fictional town of Scansi, where you have this big abbey, St. Donatus Abbey. We have to imagine the very real likelihood, and in fact this is described in the book, that most of the town of Scansi would have been owned by the abbey. So most people paid their rent through the abbey. Their landlord was the abbey. Probably most their employers were the abbey, because the local bakers were ferrying most of their bread to the abbey. It was the economic and employment hub of the community. And that was the case across the country. They were also the principal providers of healthcare and of education and of charity and you name it. There was no state infrastructure in place for any of this. It was all handled by the monasteries. And this is why there was uproar. There were riots in the north of England in particular when Cromwell dissolved the monasteries, because people's employment fell down the toilet. No one had healthcare anymore. Because if you were sick or you were diseased or your arm was falling off, you went to the local infirmary in the monastery. And that is something that's depicted in these Charles Lake books. And that led to, historically speaking, riots in the north of England and demands from the peasantry in the north for Cromwell's head. He narrowly got away with it.
I've only watched the first episode.
I believe it's a four.
Four in total.
Right.
But there are a series of books, so I guess we have to wait to see how successful this series is before we know.
Yes, I couldn't possibly comment. I'm just the
humble
historian, all of that.
Right, indeed.
You take me beyond my purview.
But this has been really interesting. Thanks so much, Peter. And listeners, it's going to be out. I will links are in the show notes, and I think we're coming out in a 4th of May, Patrick, remind me?
1st of May, I think.
1st of May.
Yeah.
God, I'm getting very low marks today, aren't I? but yeah, thanks very much for your time, Peter.
Thank you, Oliver. It's been a great pleasure.